sense. It's like there's just a real sense of family, even though there are hundreds of us there. Everybody yesterday was asking me to report on this gravity wave detection discovery. It is a big deal. I mean, the press is all over it. But I'm here to share with you that they didn't make as big enough a deal as they should have made. There's a lot more to the discovery that really didn't get reported. So I'll share that with you briefly today. By the way, on my Facebook page, you'll actually see a short article on the significance of the discovery. And I'm trying to get caught up with all the questions I'm getting based on that. But you'll probably see a couple of dots there. So let me bring up the map that kind of shows you what this experiment is. And it's two laser interferometers, one in the state of Louisiana and one in the state of Washington. And this is what the laser interferometer looks like. This is the one that's in Hanford, Washington. And they picked Hanford. By the way, Hanford is a place where they did a lot of the atomic bomb work for World War II. And so the government has cordoned off a large area. And so it's a great place to do science experiments because, as you can see, there really isn't any business services going on in the area. And so what you have here are two long arms with laser beams going back and forth with mirrors there at the corners. And basically what this instrument is designed to do, here's a close-up that you can look at just to see how long that laser arm is. And what they're doing is they're bouncing laser beams back and forth looking for tiny disturbances in the force. So that's basically what got discovered yesterday. They found a disturbance in the force of gravity. But gravity is the weakest of the four forces of physics. And, you know, it was Einstein's theory of relativity that predicted that the force of gravity would actually emanate waves. Just like you would see in the force of electromagnetism. The problem is the force of gravity is 10 to the 40 times weaker than the force of electromagnetism. So it's easy to pick up electromagnetic waves, extremely difficult to pick up gravitational waves. But this is an experiment that's been going on for about 15 years, has been recently upgraded. And the whole idea is to look for a tiny movement in the ground here. And you say, well, earthquakes do that, right? Trucks going by do that. Matter of fact, if I can take it back to the map here, this instrument is so sensitive in measuring ground movements that, for example, the waves that crash on the beach off the coast of Washington can be picked up by the detector. It literally can measure movements in the ground by less than the diameter of a proton. And I've written about this before, how this actually ranks as the most sophisticated machine or instrument that human beings have ever built. It can make measurements to one part in 10 to the 24th power. And in fact, if you read my books, I actually use this as a device to compare the fine-tuning that we see in the universe to the very best example of human fine-tuning design. This is the finest instrument, the most highly fine-tuned instrument that we human beings have ever built. But when you compare it to the fine-tuning that we see, say, in dark energy, it ranks 10 to the 99 times inferior to what God did with the universe just in one parameter. And I've done that with a few other of the design features of the universe. I think what's remarkable, we can actually point to several design factors in the universe where the fine-tuning is orders and orders and orders of magnitude greater than what we human beings have achieved with the epitome of our technology. But this is an amazing instrument, and nothing less than this had the possibility of directly detecting gravitational waves. Now, the way the instrument works is that you've got trucks running by here, you've got waves, you've got tiny earthquakes, you've got people talking, you've got birds flying by, all that will disturb the instrument. But it'll disturb the instrument in a different way than it does in the state of Washington. And so they had, in fact, a lot of the sophistication here is in the software. What the software does is searches all the data coming in to these two instruments and basically eliminates everything that's different at the two sites. And so if they see a disturbance in the mirrors and the laser beams at this site that's identical to the one they see at the other site, then they know it came from outer space. Because all the ground movements here that are terrestrial will be different than the ground movements that are in the state of Washington. And by the way, this wasn't part of the discovery, but they've now put a third arm in Pisa, Italy. The Europeans thought that Galileo needed to be honored since that was his hometown. They now have a third arm there, but it's not yet as sophisticated and well-designed as what we see here in Louisiana and Washington. It's going to get there. So the discovery was based just on these two sites. Now, there's actually a plan to upgrade this site and make it even more sensitive, because what was going on, for 10 years they've been searching for gravity waves and getting nothing. And this was designed so that if two gigantic black holes were to collide with one another and merge, it would generate a signal that could be detected. But they weren't getting anything, and they said, I think what we're going to have to do is make the instrument sensitive enough that if two neutron stars were to collide and merge, we would get a signal. Well, what's happened is it actually discovered two medium-sized black holes colliding and merging, and it gave a signal. And so we weren't even sure such black holes existed, but now we know that these black holes indeed do exist. Matter of fact, I can quickly give you here. This is really what was discovered on Thursday, published in, by the way, you can read the paper for yourself, at least the abstract is available to anybody for free. It's in Physical Review Letters. If you just go to Physical Review Letters, it pops right up. And by the way, you'll see lots of articles put out by different scientists. But typically the reports make the point that it's the first direct detection of gravity waves. And by the way, we have found indirect evidence for gravity waves. So, for example, astronomers have been studying for nearly a 30-year period the orbit of two neutron stars about one another. And what we found is that the neutron stars are slowly spiraling in towards one another. And so they're able to measure the shrinking of the orbit. And Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that shrinkage of the orbit would be due to gravitational radiation. And part of that gravitational radiation would be the emanating of gravity waves. But they call it indirect because it simply proves that there's gravitational energy being emanated as a result of the inspiraling of the two neutron stars towards one another. So that's why they say this is the first direct detection of gravity waves. But that we've had indirect detections before. But I think what's even more significant, it's the first direct detection of black holes. All of our observations of black holes to date have been indirect. This is a direct detection. And this is important because even within the Christian community, particularly within the younger creationist community, there's been papers written and articles written making the point physicists have got it all wrong. And all they got is indirect evidence for black holes. Black holes don't really exist. Well, this is now demonstrating a direct detection of black holes. Because only a black hole merger event would give you gravity waves. Yes?
Are they able to tell where the black holes are?
Very roughly. We know the black holes are in a galaxy about 1.3 billion light years away. But the instrument's not sensitive enough to say, this is the galaxy. But yeah, we got a rough idea of the distance. And yeah, it's got a fairly big plus or minus. Yes?
I read it as 400 square degrees, which is a third of the size.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, we've got a rough idea of the distance. The location is not well determined. So now, what you won't see in the popular literature, but you will see it in the paper. By the way, this event happened not on Thursday. It got published on Thursday. It actually happened a couple of years ago, and the problem is it takes that long to process the data. And in the processing of the data, they think they've actually got a second event. So it may not be long before they got two of these, but they said we can't really claim it yet because we're still processing the data. Yes?
What's the period of the wave?
The period of the wave, I don't know that offhand. So, yes?
I read that there's a difference between gravitational wave and gravity wave.
A gravitational wave and a gravity wave.
That a gravity wave would be emanated gravity, but a gravitational wave is just the wave rippling through space.
Yeah, they're picking up the ripple through space, but it is generated by gravity waves being given off by the merger event. So that's what's happening. Yes. By the way, there's a lot of light coming in here. So if I'm not catching your hand, just kind of get a little more aggressive. Yes.
Can you explain why the merger of two black holes can be the only source for detection of gravity?
Yes. I mean, that's simply based on the sensitivity of the instrument.
Okay.
So if two neutron stars were to merge, this instrument wouldn't pick it up. It doesn't have the sensitivity to pick it up. And by the way, let me just go down here. I'll take a few more questions. It's the first time they've seen a black hole binary. So we found indirect evidence for black holes before, but we've never found any evidence for a black hole binary. So this is a first. It's the first time we've seen a merger of black holes, but this is probably the most significant discovery of all, because they're able to determine the masses of the two black holes that existed before the merger and what the mass is after the merger. So the two black holes were coming in at 29 times the mass of the Sun and 35 times the mass of the Sun. And when the merger event was over, they had 62 times the mass of the Sun. Now, you can all do the math in your head, right? That means three solar masses are missing. And those three solar masses are gravitational energy. So, I mean, that's how dramatic this event is. But yeah, because of how weak the force of gravity is, nothing less than the merger of two black holes would enable the instrument to even pick up the signal. So yeah, it would take a major gravitational disturbance to get anything. And in the astronomical community, there was a lot of doubt that these black holes even existed. Now, we found lots of evidence for small black holes. What I mean by small black holes, something like 2 to 5 times the mass of our star, the Sun. And they've got evidence for black holes in the center of globular clusters that come in at around 10,000 times the mass of the Sun. And in the center of galaxies, millions of times, even billions of times the mass of the Sun. So we're seeing the really big ones, we're seeing the really small ones, but no astronomer until Thursday came up with any evidence for these kinds of black holes. And that's where the really exciting science exists. It exists here, but this is the one that's getting all the attention, number one. Yes?
First, I'm surprised to see those 4 months ago, September 14th, I believe, that they eventually detected. And of course they got to go through, because it's so monumental maybe, they have to have so many double checks before they publish.
There's some politics involved here.
Let me just ask.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it have been prudent to do as much as you can? We think we found it, so there might be some possibility of confirmation in electromagnetic, or is that?
Okay. Let me give the historical background. Here's the problem. Years ago, it was well known throughout the physics and astronomy community, the first one to make a positive detection of gravity waves will get the Nobel Prize. Because, you mean, it is such a monumental, and it's been something that people have been looking for. It's a key component of Einstein's theory of general relativity. It has a huge impact on our cosmic creation models. So, yeah, everybody knew this would be a Nobel Prize winning event. Okay. A couple of years ago, back at the South Pole, you got the BICEP 2 people who were measuring the cosmic background radiation. They published a paper where they said, we have found gravity waves. And so they were trying to get out in front to get the Nobel Prize, right? Well, what happened is several astronomers looked at their data and said, you didn't properly subtract off the dust of our galaxy from the cosmic background radiation signal, and therefore we don't think you've got a positive detection of gravity waves. And so in embarrassment, they had to withdraw their claim. And that, by the way, led to, probably some of you are aware of this, a lot of people in the Christian community said astronomers are all wrong about inflation, because really the goal of the BICEP 2 is they said, we found the gravity waves that explained the inflation event that happened when the universe was 10 to the minus 35 seconds old. And there's certain Christians that really don't like inflation. I do. I think it's a crucial, but you know, the people who don't like it are people who don't like Big Bang cosmology at all. And they say the inflation is wrong, and it's a bicep too. It just shows you these scientists are being deceptive, and they're being, well, what really happened was, yes, they didn't properly account for the dust contribution to the signal of the polarization of the cosmic background radiation, but they basically said, you know what, we're going to keep working on it. And it was literally just 2 months ago that Bicep 2 published a paper in the Astrophysical Journal where they said, we've done a much better job accounting for the dust, and now we have a signal for gravity waves that is 4 standard deviations above the noise. They said, we know this is not enough to claim a discovery. The standard in physics has got to be 5 times above the noise. They said, but we're getting close. And they said, within a few months, we'll probably be at the 5 sigma level. And so this is, I think, was one reason what was going on here with LIGO, as I said, we need to speed up our data processing because we don't want to be beat out by Bicep 2. And so they began, you know, going aggressively at the data. And so come Thursday, they said, we now have done enough data analysis to show a signal. But there were some people in the group that said, we'd probably better if we waited till we had 2 events. And they saw what looked like a signal from a second event. Other groups said, no, we need to publish now because we got a positive signal that tells us one event took place. And by the way, look at the masses that are coming in. This is too important to sit on and wait and accumulate more data. And that's just kind of a little bit of the sociology of physics, is that you've got different groups with different research projects kind of targeting the same goal. And actually, what could happen, it wouldn't surprise me if Bicep 2 comes out with their result in a month or two. Maybe they're going to get more aggressive processing their data. Because what you have at Bicep 2 is a completely different technique for detecting gravity waves when you got here. It's not as direct as what you got here. However, the two discoveries would really fit beautifully together. And it wouldn't surprise me the Nobel Prize Committee decides to award the prize to both groups. By the way, typically the Nobel Prize is given to just 3 people maximum. This is going to be a challenge because there's several thousand physicists and astronomers that have their names on these LIGO papers. And likewise, the Bicep 2 team, I think there's only hundreds that are contributing to that. And there really isn't a standout leader in either group. So... But hey, Al Gore already set the standard, right? For the Nobel Peace Prize, they got, 1,000 names on it? So maybe they'll make an exception. And by the way, that's actually going on with the Nobel Committee. What are we going to do with this discovery? There's way too many names involved. And again, nobody really stands out. And by the way, that's a recent phenomena in physics and astronomy, where you got these research projects with literally over 1,000 names attached to them. It's been routine in particle physics, literally, for 20 years, but now it's beginning to filter into other disciplines of physics and astronomy, where the projects are so big, so long in being able to develop results. I mean, after all, you're pouring 20 years of work into getting one result. And this is not something that you can do as an individual or a small group, because, you know, your funding sources aren't going to wait 20 years. But if you've got thousands of people involved, then it's, and you got an instrument that's expensive, then you find that the funding organizations are more patient. So there's a reason why you see so many people involved in these kinds of experiments. Okay, I'll take a few questions, but I got a lot more to say about this. Yes, who's next? Yes.
I think I remember a number of years ago that you said that the discovery of gravity waves would have some implications about a multiverse. Is that right?
Okay, I'll get to that.
Okay.
Probably the 3 biggest apologetic takeaways from this discovery. Number one, there's been a lot of criticism of physicists and astronomers when it comes to cosmology that, hey, they don't know what they're doing. Or they're engaging in hubris or deception. And this discovery basically is confirmation. You know what? They really do know what they're doing. They've been right all along, and everything is consistent here. It's all fitting together in a harmonious way, and therefore we need to have greater confidence in what they're actually achieving. And the very fact that the governments of the world are willing to fund this for 20 years, typically that doesn't happen unless they think they're going to get the result that they're searching for. So I think it's going to give people a lot more confidence. I've already noticed within the Christian community, you're seeing people saying, okay, you know, I don't understand this, but I think it's something we can trust. So that's one takeaway. The second takeaway is that this is confirming predictions of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Two major predictions that he made, namely that there would be black holes, and these black holes would have certain characteristics. And with the discovery of black holes at this mass range, the fact that we saw a merger event, a black hole event, this is giving us a lot more information about black hole physics that we'd never had until this past Thursday. And all of it fits beautifully into Einstein's theory of general relativity. Now, I say this because there's been a lot of papers published by physicists who are basically saying Einstein's theory of general relativity, but with significant adjustments. Those significant adjustments would give you very different kinds of black holes than what this discovery has demonstrated. So it's basically saying the standard general relativistic model is the correct model. So that's important. And then the second prediction, which is what's gotten all the publicity, Einstein's theory of general relativity predicted that there'd be gravity waves associated with the force of gravity. And yeah, that's what's gotten all the attention. That's the most obvious confirmation. Now, why is this important? It's important because the theory of general relativity, starting in the 1968 actually, and going all the way up to the year 2004, produced 30 space-time theorems. These space-time theorems are valid if the theory of general relativity, as developed by Albert Einstein, is correct. And the latest of those theorems has this as its conclusion, that any universe that expands on average, where general relativity operates throughout the entirety of the universe, has a space-time beginning. So these space-time theorems literally prove that space and time were created entities. And this implies that there must be a causal agent beyond space and time, transcendent to space and time, who creates space-time, matter, and energy. So the fact that we can now give greater confidence to the theory of general relativity gives us greater confidence to the space-time theorem. But this is what was stated by Alexander Vilenkin. Notice he's one of the three authors. And he wrote a book after the 2004 space-time theorem was published. And this is what he wrote in that book. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. And what is that problem? A causal agent outside of space and time must have created the whole shebang. And that's not going to sit down well with non-theists, for obvious reasons. But this discovery of gravity waves is basically saying, hey, it's an even stronger proof. It was strong enough before Thursday. It's much stronger now. And by the way, general relativity, even before Thursday, ranked as the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in all of physics. But yeah, this is the biggest outstanding test of general relativity that had not yet been confirmed. Now it's been confirmed. And so this should be a cause of rejoicing from all Christians, because now we have an even stronger proof in place that cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There really must be this agent beyond space and time. Now, let me drive down another theological point here. If you look at the Eastern faiths, things like Hinduism, Buddhism, what you notice is they teach. And by the way, this goes into some of the Christian philosophy. Immanuel Kant taught this as well, that space and time are eternal entities and that God creates within space and time. It's the God of the Bible that stands apart and says, no, space and time don't exist until God creates space and time. So instead of God creating within space and time, it's God creating outside of space and time. Now, I say the God of the Bible because we also see this in certain cults. So, for example, you see in Jehovah's Witness the same idea. You see it in Mormonism. You see it in Islam. This idea that God indeed creates outside of space and time. But guess where they got it from? They got it from the Bible. And so I typically refer to Islam as a Christian cult, because it's kind of just like Mormonism. They take the Old Testament and they add to it. There's a Latter-day Prophet, a Latter-day Book, and the Latter-day Prophet and the Latter-day Book contradict what's in the Old and the New Testament. But the God of the Bible, and this is where these cultic religions get the doctrine of the beginning of space and time from, and a God outside of space and time. They get it exclusively from the Bible. Yes?
On Mormonism, I think that would not be counted. Orson Pratt, apostle, early apostle, said there never was a time when there were no gods or worlds. And so Mormonism teaches that the universe was eternal.
In that context,
in their
theology. Yeah. So, okay.
How does this help kind of refute the idea of imaginary time in equations to adjust relativity for a no boundary? Just take that step off the table?
Well, that was what Einstein did in his book, A Brief History of Time, based on a paper he wrote with James Hartle out at UC Santa Barbara, was to say, well, the space-time theorems tell us that there's this beginning of space and time. In fact, Hawking was one of the first physicists involved in developing a space-time theorem. That was the conclusion. But with James Hartle, he speculated, well, what if we have, in addition to real time, imaginary time? Now, for those of you who haven't taken complex variables, what that really is all about is speculating that instead of there being one dimension of time for the universe, there's the equivalent of two dimensions of time. And so when you do mathematics about imaginary time, it really is the equivalent of a second time dimension. And with that, you can escape the conclusion of the theorem. But if you actually read A Brief History of Time and the paper he wrote with James Hartle, there's an important concession there. You know, this would allow us to escape the conclusion of the space-time theorems, but of course we know the universe is subject to real time and only to real time, which means the theorem really does hold. So it's a speculative idea that if the universe were actually subject to two dimensions of time instead of one, you could escape the conclusion. Well, it's kind of the same thing. This paper is saying that there must be an agent that's not subject to cosmic time or cosmic space that creates it. So I've written on this making the point that he's actually invoking another causal agent outside of time that creates. So, yes?
The second part of my question is there any possibility or of electromagnetic confirmation of LIGO?
Well, probably not. What this did do, and I should have put this on the list as well, it did show that gravity waves travel at the velocity of light. And that's an important confirmation of the standard model of particle physics. That was built into the standard model, but we had no real proof of that. This gives us evidence for that, that indeed the gravity travels at the velocity of light. So, yes?
Related to that, I understand that also opened a new window of seeing the universe, like we had infrared, sort of visible light. I read where now we can see the universe in terms of gravity, gravitatory eventually. Is that...
Well, it's an important window in that dust and electromagnetic radiation is not going to interfere with it. There are parts of the universe where we can't get a good look at it because there's bright stuff in front of us or there's a dust cloud in front of us. And so using electromagnetic telescopes, there are certain block zones. Well, nothing's going to block gravity.
How practical, realistic is it that we'll actually be able to use it in that way?
You're going to have a lot more tax dollars put into these kinds of experiments. A lot more. I forget the price tag on this experiment, but it's not cheap. Yes?
So what was the strength of the disturbance that they detected comparatively to other things? So was it like an earthquake? Was it like a...
No.
Was it like a bird flapping its wings?
It'd be kind of like a hummingbird fluttering its wings several miles away. I mean, and we're talking something incredibly weak.
Okay.
And that analogy may be an exaggeration. It may be something much weaker than that again. So it'd be good to come up with an analogy. But keep in mind what they're measuring are disturbances that are smaller than the width of a proton. So we're talking about very tiny disturbances. And this instrument is not yet sensitive enough to pick up a merger event of two neutron stars.
So this might sound like a silly question, but you know, if you go back to your map of where the two detectors are, I can imagine that not equidistant, but you know, at some point in between those two points, there could be some kind of earthquake or an event that would create a disturbance that would be received by both of those detectors at equal strength.
Well, okay.
So how do they know that's not what's happening?
Well, the instrument is so sensitive that say we had an earthquake halfway between, because the ground structure is different, it's going to wind up giving you a different...
That's why I said maybe not halfway between, but somewhere between those two, an event could happen that could produce an equal signal at each of those two points.
Okay.
Right? So how do they know that's not going to happen?
Okay. Any kind of earthquake is going to give you orders of magnitude stronger signal than what you would get from two black holes merging together.
Okay.
So yeah, if the signal's too big, then they know that can't be what they're looking for.
Well, I don't know, some kid didn't just like stamp the ground or something. I mean, it's kind of a silly question, but I mean, if it's really that sensitive and it can pick up...
Actually...
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I read about that, and one thing, if you see the graphs, the beautiful graphs, the distance between the two, the timing between the two was just right, and something called the ring down matched exactly what they had predicted of when, after they merge, you know, it fades off at a certain
right
in shape, and that fit perfectly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not just one spike.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's the timing, too. You're going to get a slightly different timing at these two sites, so they can take that into account. Yes?
So these signals that they're taking apart, can they pick up something even like they happen on Earth? Could they say dinosaurs and those noises, or I think something like that being detected, or is that kind of thrown out of the equation?
Yeah, I mean, dinosaurs were stomping around, 50 million years ago, and there's kind of a ringing of a vibration that lasts for a few minutes. For it to last 50 million years, no, that's not going to happen. So, but if somebody's stomping around, yeah, you're going to get a signal.
I have a second question, because on APOD, the astronomy picture of the day, they showed the merger of these two black holes, and they said that, and I'm imagining these as being these huge things, much larger than our sun. They showed it kind of slow motion, but they said it actually happens in less than a millisecond or something, I guess. Could you just address, I mean, how these two huge things could merge so quickly?
Yeah. Have you ever been in one of these stores where they kind of got one of these kind of funnels and you put a coin down and it goes round and round and round and round like that? What you notice is when it gets close to the hole, it's really moving fast. And that was what happened with two black holes that are orbiting one another, is that they'll be far apart, and because they're black holes, they are slowly losing gravitational energy, so they begin to get closer and closer to one another. The closer they get, the faster they orbit one another. And then as they get close, the more faster they begin to come towards one another. So yeah, the actual merger event is very quick. So, yes.
What verse says that God created time?
Pardon me?
What verse says that God created time?
Okay. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth implies the totality of reality, all of physical reality. Or as Hebrews 11:3 says, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. We can detect space and time. Probably the most direct passages would be Titus 1:2 and 2 Timothy 1:9. 2 Timothy 1:9, the grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time. Or Titus 1:2, the hope that we share in Jesus Christ was granted to us before the beginning of time. And this is a key doctrine of the Christian faith, that God's acts of redemption predate his acts of creation. And therefore, to what we're to understand everything that God creates in the context of redemption. And that's kind of my hermeneutic in terms of creation theology, is every biblical text I look at that speaks about creation, how can that be interpreted in light of God's works of redemption? And keep in mind, you've got Romans 8, 23, which makes the point that once God's works of redemption are complete, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. And God will remove it from existence and replace it with a brand new realm with radically different laws of physics and radically different dimensionality. It may not even be space-time dimensionality, but it will be radically different than what we have here in this universe. So you've got some direct statements, but also a lot of implied statements that you see in the Bible. And, you know, and this has been part of Christian theology literally back to the first and second century. So this is not something new that people picked out of the text driven by physics, as some Christian theologians have claimed. No, this has been around a long, long time. In the back.
Yeah, you may have answered this before I arrived, but the papers, I understand, said that the resulting black hole from the merger had like three solar masses less mass than the two the two precursors, and that all went into energy that presumably is the gravitational waves.
Waves? So yeah, this is incredible. 5% of the mass of the two black holes that merged together was converted into gravitational energy.
Okay, and how would they determine that mass of the single event afterward? I could see how they do that with the two black holes separately, but once they merge, how do they determine what that mass is?
Well, they're basically looking at the signals they saw at both sites, and they're actually able to observe what was happening as the black holes got close and then merged together, and by that means are able to determine the masses both before the merger event and after the merger event. Now, there's been some discussion in the paper, well, maybe, because, I mean, keep in mind, the error bars are fairly large on this, and they were making the point, you know, there could have been even bigger masses before, but as we began to make the observations, one came in at 29 times the mass of the sun, the other one came in at 35 times the mass of the sun, and they wound up with 62 at the end. Now, if you look at the paper, it's like plus or minus. Let me see if I actually see it here in the paper. It's very tiny print, but it's like, I think it's like plus or minus two solar masses. So it's hard to say we actually have an accurate measure of how much gravitational energy is emitted, because of the fact that the error bars are quite substantial, just like they weren't able to get an accurate fix on where this event took place. Now, the paper closes by making a point that if we find more events like this, then we're going to get a lot more information on what's happening here when black holes merge. It's hard to make a case where you got one event with big error bars, but we get several events. And actually, this is going to be a big push, because there's what is being proposed by the team is what they call the Advanced LIGO 2, which is basically to upgrade this system to make it much more precise than it already is, upgrade the other arm that's in Pisa, Italy, and, you know, all these questions we got about subtracting off the noise that generated by the Earth. If you got a third site, then it's not just a piece of cake. It's going to enable you to get down to sufficiently precise levels that now we can work on neutron stars. And that's really the goal of the advanced system, is that not only are we going to be able to detect black hole mergers, we're going to be able to detect neutron star mergers. And we already know there's lots of neutron stars around. And so the probability of finding those events is much higher. In fact, papers have been published making the point, if we actually upgrade this system where we can detect neutron star mergers, we're probably going to be running around two or three events a year. And, you know, that's going to be exciting, because now you actually can build up some data to be able to do some significant theoretical work on the physics of gravity with neutron stars. And as I already mentioned, the team has already said, we think we've got signals that are indicating a second black hole merger, which has really got the astronomical community excited, because they're saying maybe that means we're in a position where we can get an average of a black hole merger every year. And if we're getting one every year, by the way, just a few weeks ago, papers were published saying maybe we'll be lucky if we get one a century. Mm-hmm. And that was really depressing. I mean, all those tax dollars, thousands of researchers involved, and we're only going to get one event a century. And then groups of people saying, maybe we're not going to get any at all. So, and others have been saying, what we need to really work for is look at these super giant black holes that are in the center of a galaxy. And papers have been published making the point there might be a galaxy out there where they got two super giant black holes in the core. Say one with 1 million times the mass of the sun, another one with 10 million times the mass of the sun. They're orbiting one another, and maybe they could merge, and we're going to really get a big signal. So that could still happen, but also papers have been published saying that's not how galaxies work. But other people saying, well, you know, if we find that, that could lead us to some new understanding of a galaxy formation. So this is why the community is excited. But before I take any more questions, let me get down to what I think is the most, the biggest payoff of all. It's number five here. The fact that we've seen black holes in this mass range for the first time, when there's been literally dozens of papers speculating that they don't exist at all. Now there's no doubt that black holes of that mass range do exist. And here's where you get the astronomical payoff. How do you get black holes of that mass? The only viable models I've seen in the published literature is that black holes of that mass can only come from the firstborn stars that are running between 100 and 200 times the mass of the sun. And if those kinds of firstborn stars exist, it has a dramatic impact on the creation model, the Big Bang creation model, and the physics of star formation. And by the way, there's been a lot of noise going on from atheists as well as young Earth creationists that we astronomers have it all wrong because we can't even detect the firstborn stars. And we have no idea what these firstborn stars are like. Moreover, at that early epoch of the universe, all you got is hydrogen and helium, and some have been speculating if all you got is hydrogen and helium, it's impossible for stars to form. And yet we've got stars here, and so they're saying we have to abandon the standard Big Bang model. But there's also been papers saying, hey, with hydrogen and helium, and getting the formation of hydrogen molecules where you got hydrogen 2 and hydrogen 3, you really can get stars forming without any other elements existing, and they'd be coming in at mass ranges that would produce these kinds of black holes. But the fact that we found those black holes tells us this very likely. I mean, it's possible you could get black holes of that mass without the firstborn stars, but I would say probably 99% certain the only way you're going to get them is if you've got the firstborn stars coming in at that mass range. Yes?
I got a revelation. This is a large one of the details about this. LIGO has been going on for a while, and then they recently found ways to upgrade mainly software. I spent, I forgot if it was 3 or 5 months doing it. Within seconds after they went back online, they caught this event, they caught
right.
The ringing down. And I thought, it just seemed like you were saying, now we're in an open space in our galaxy, saying, God saying, here you go. It's wonderful.
Well, you're making a good point. Sometimes it's better to invest in software than it is in hardware. But I can tell you, it took a lot of people writing software to make this thing work. It wasn't just one engineer.
All of them only called Kip Thorne and two others. So I guess that's where they go to.
Yeah, well, Kip Thorne here at Caltech, he's been working on black holes for 40 years. He's kind of known as Mr. Black Hole. So, questions over here. Yeah.
As we come to understand gravity waves, I don't read my question. It's been a while here. Could we use them to as a detection source to look further back in time towards the Big Bang?
Okay, I think what you're talking about, can we actually use these black holes as a gravitational lens?
Right.
We're actually using stars as gravitational lenses. That's what's called microlensing, where you can detect a planet. So, for example, we've actually found planets in the Andromeda Galaxy. We found them by using a star that's exactly between us and the planet, and therefore we can see the planet. And we found planets in the center of our galaxy that way as well. So actually we can find planets that are fairly far away by that means. A black hole could do that too. Keep in mind though, it only works if you're trying to use stars or black holes as a gravitational lens. You've got to be perfectly in the line of sight. If you're off by a little bit, you won't get a strong enough signal that you can detect it with a ground-based telescope. And this is why, in terms of microlensing, they've been targeting planets that are in very dense star regions. And so, for example, we've been able to use that technique to find a planet in the center of our galaxy, but not anywhere else. The reason why is there isn't sufficient density of stars anywhere else that we'd be lucky enough to pick up one that's exactly in the line of sight. Likewise, the center of the Andromeda Galaxy. So yeah, you could use these black holes, but you're going to have to be exactly in the line of sight. And astronomers are not very hopeful that that's going to work. For one thing, we don't have very many of these black holes. And there's nothing exactly behind it. You're not going to see anything. And incidentally, this thing's 1.3 billion light years away, and that's much too distant for that kind of micro lensing. Now, you got what's called the macro lensing. The macro lensing is where they use a cluster of galaxies to be the gravitational lens to lens a galaxy behind. And that you can use out to billions of light years. And you actually get and by the way, it doesn't have to be perfectly in the line of sight. It can be a little bit off. I think a few weeks ago I talked about how they discovered a supernova in a distant galaxy that they got to see erupt several times because it was gravitationally lensed. And that was a case where the gravitational lens was a little bit off center, and so they were able to see the supernova erupt back 15 years ago because it took this pathway to get to our telescope. And then they found another one where they got to see the supernova erupt again about a year ago. And then a couple of weeks ago, or early January, they saw it erupt again. And they're predicting they're going to get a fourth eruption next year. And it's because they're using different parts of the gravitational lens to get the eruption of the supernova. And by the way, that's the first experiment that proves that the velocity of light travels at the same velocity in all directions. And that has resolved a major rebuttal proposal within the young Earth community. They've been actually speculating, hey, light gets here instantly because the velocity of light travels at infinite speeds towards the Earth and only half the velocity of light away from the Earth, taking advantage of the fact that we astronomers can only measure the return path of the velocity of light. But the supernova actually refutes that. It basically shows, hey, it's the same in all directions. Well, it refutes that because you had a gravitational lens that's imaging the supernova, and because the gravitational lens is slightly off-center, you're getting different light travel paths with different directions from different components, because you know, it's a cluster of galaxies that's doing it, so you're going to get different parts of the lens, and it's going to cause the supernova signal to arrive at different times here on planet Earth. And they've already detected two of them, and there's a third one coming, predicted next year. But just the fact that they found the two is sufficient to refute the hypothesis.
Well, how do they deal with E equals MC squared? You change any one of those parts of that equation by an infinitesimally small...
Well, where the young Earth creations were correct is that what you're measuring is the return path. And so it really doesn't matter how fast the velocity of light is going for, say, the energy output of the sun, as long as the return path is okay. Since all that we can measure is return path, we're free to speculate that maybe it goes at a different velocity. By the way, it was refuted before that, because their hypothesis is only accurate for a particular direction. What they're claiming is that the velocity of light is infinite in all different directions towards the Earth. Now, the problem with that, according to the Einstein's theory of general relativity, is that means you've got a force field centered on the Earth. And so the hypothesis being proposed by Jason Lyle would actually predict that in addition to the gravitational field of the Earth, you've got a second field produced by this velocity of light phenomena. And that field would be measurable, and we don't see it. However, When I debated Jason Lyle, he says, no, I want direct refutation. What you're giving me depends on your interpretation of general relativity. Well, I thought my interpretation of general relativity was quite valid, the one that's been proven by all these experiments. But now we've got the Revesdell supernova, which actually does give a direct refutation.
And by return path, you mean?
Okay. What Jason Lyle was proposing was that the velocity of light is infinite from all stars and galaxies and planets towards the Earth. But it's only half the velocity of light if you go in the opposite direction. Therefore, he says, yeah, the velocity of light really is 300,000 kilometers per second, but it's infinite towards us and half that velocity away from us. Well, it's a pure hypothesis, but his whole point was based on the fact that physicists are limited to measuring the return path of the velocity of light. It's impossible to set up an experiment to measure the one-way velocity of light. And he's right. There is no experiment that we can design that can measure the velocity of light in one direction only. All of our experiments are return path experiments, like the one that was done on Mount Baldy and Mount Wilson more than 100 years ago. They're measuring the return path. You can't measure the one-way path. Now, the supernova, however, actually gives you the equivalent of measuring the one-way path. So, yeah, and that happened literally just a few weeks ago. Yes?
I don't know how I completely grasp this, but if he's saying that, you only observe the return path, the whole thing, well, now that we have things that could land on Mars, could we get something?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not even, because I was going to say,
We've already been to the moon.
We have mirrors.
And you know what's interesting? Physicists actually published papers in Physical Review saying we can measure the one-way velocity of light, and they appeal to the fact we've been to the moon, we got laser reflectors. But if you actually look at the detailed physics, they were wrong. And so I complimented Jason Lyle saying, yeah, you're right. These guys who claimed they had it, they really didn't. And, you would be free to hypothesize that it could be at a different velocity of way than towards, but you can't do that from all directions. If you're saying it's all directions, then Einstein's theory of general relativity would say you've got something that's causing the light to be infinite from all different directions, and that's going to set up a second gravitational field that we don't see, or some kind of field that we don't see. But his comment was that's indirect. It's all dependent on general relativity being the way the physicists claim it is. What if it's not? But now we got this direct detection. Yes.
How will Jason Lyle spin this direct data? How will you respond, and why will people still believe Jason Lyle?
Well, Jason Lyle has been silent on the discovery.
So far.
So, and what he said, and I debated him, was, well, if I'm proven wrong, well, that's okay, but because I'm convinced that the universe is only 6,000 years old, there's got to be another explanation. But, they propose 8 different explanations. And it's kind of like, we were talking earlier before class how there's been a resurrected flat Earth group.
Yeah. You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. Oh. You can go online. The flat earthers are claiming that they got a model to explain away all the evidence for a spherical Earth. And the way you deal with these kinds of things is to show that with respect to time, their attempts to support their model become progressively more and more absurd. And so you've still got geocentrists, you've still got the flat earth people, you've still got atheists.
Got the office people.
Yes. But you can show that over the course of, say, several decades, they've been pushed to more and more absurd hypotheses to support their model. And so this thing from Jason Lyle, I just thought, this is really way out. But it just demonstrates how desperate they are in attempts to support their model.
But they always find an audience, and a naive audience that latches onto it.
Yeah, well, I'm actually working on a paper that's basically, I think I got it titled, How to Refute the Non-Empirical Case for Atheism. Because that's what's happening with atheism today. They're saying, we don't know X, we're free to speculate about what we don't know, and we think we can escape the existence of God. And I'm actually going to use these other models, you know, where people are saying, hey, the Earth really is flat, and there's some certain things we don't understand about the sphericity of the Earth, and from there we can escape the conclusion. And the way you deal with that is basically by demonstrating that as evidence accumulates, from empirical evidence accumulates, it means that the non-empirical case gets progressively more and more absurd, but it will never go away. The only way it will completely go away is if we know absolutely everything about the universe, and that'll never happen. And by the way, that's a favorite atheist challenge of Christianity, where they basically say, hey, until you can close off all the gaps, we're not going to believe. Well, guess what? Gaps are always going to exist in science. But if you can show that the gaps of their model are getting bigger and ours are getting smaller, you've got a powerful case. And the bottom line is, we should argue for beliefs based on what we do know and don't base it on what we don't know. So, yes?
Radio waves, we know at JPL, it takes about 35 minutes for a radio wave to reach Mars.
Yes.
So it's not instantaneous.
Yes.
Radio waves travel at the speed of light. So it's not instantaneous. So how do they get around that?
Well, what they're making the point is, say you want to communicate with a device on Mars. You're basically sending a signal out and waiting for a signal to come back. So you're basically measuring the return trip. And yeah, it really is true. We got no direct instrumental way to measure the one-way velocity of light. And you know, there are PhD physicists and mathematicians who thought we could. And so, yeah, again, I commend Jason Lyle by pointing out, you know, hey, they're brilliant, they're well-educated, but they didn't really think through all the instrumental issues that are going on here.
On Mars, so then you would,
no, you still can't.
When you say return path, you mean two-way.
Two-way path, right.
You mean
right.
Round trip.
Round trip. Okay, round trip is better. Thank you. Yeah, we can measure the round trip. We can't measure the one-way. Okay, in the back. And by the way, I'm trying to get to Ecclesiastes 4. But go ahead.
You may have already covered this already, but they're saying that this discovery will change the way we look at it with the astronomy in the future. How will it change?
Yeah, that boast that was made actually has some validity. This is going to have a major impact on how we look at the history of the universe. And its major impact is basically down here. The fact that we're finding these black holes. It has a major impact in that we now have a direct detection of black holes. I mean, there have actually been people making the point that, hey, the physicists are deceiving themselves. They're not really seeing black holes. Well, we really are. And the population statistics is going to have a huge impact on our cosmic creation models. The next step is to find out how many of these medium-sized black holes exist. If we know the numbers, that's going to tell us a lot about how galaxies form. For example, there's a lot of speculation going on in the astronomical literature. When the first stars form, is it 100 per galaxy? Is it 1,000 per galaxy? Or 10,000 per galaxy? And what are their average masses? What is the mass range? Are some of them like 40 times the mass of the Sun, and some of them 150? Or are they all coming in around 60 to 80? Those are the kinds of questions that are bouncing around the astronomical community. This is one way we can get answers to those kinds of questions. And some astronomers have pointed out it may be the only way. Well, I think that's a little bit of a stretch. Why? Because I'm confident that you taxpayers out there are actually going to fund the building of a 100-foot diameter telescope on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii. By the way, what's holding that up are the natives that are saying, that's a sacred site for us. We don't want telescopes up there. We want you to tear down the telescopes that have been built there. And that's a big legal fight that's been going on for over a decade. But fortunately, they don't have those problems in the desert of Chile. And so they're actually building a 120-foot diameter optical telescope in Chile. And that instrument probably is going to be powerful enough to detect the light from the firstborn stars. Not just the aftermath of the firstborn stars, but the actual light of the firstborn stars.
I got a question.
Yes.
Who designed internet radio reception so that you could hear stations from all over the world crystal clear without static or fading?
I have no idea. Does anybody know the answer to that question? I have no idea. Sorry.
Gravity waves are coming from the clock.
Gravity waves are coming from the clock. All right. Okay. Quick summary. Last week we got into Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And by the way, I'll be around answering questions about this gravity wave thing. And you'll see some of the answers I have to the questions on my Facebook and Twitter page. Ecclesiastes 4, we're into those two paragraphs that make the point that one of the gifts that God has given us is that we die physically. You say, how can that be a gift? Basically makes the point that since we're sinners, what takes place is that humans have this tendency to accumulate goods. To accumulate not just material goods, but we accumulate intellectual goods. And basically the text is saying that God blesses us with physical death to force us to think about who's going to get our stuff. Whether it be money or intellectual property, we all have to think about the fact that we're not going to live forever and someone's going to inherit what we leave behind. We need to be thinking who's going to inherit and what are they going to do with it. And so the fact that we all face physical death over a few decades forces all of us, the righteous and the wicked, to think seriously about that thing. And basically the text is saying is one tool that God blesses humanity with to keep evil in check. So that the man who hoards all his wealth, he's going to have to transfer it. If he never died, what if we live forever? Then they would just keep hoarding it and hoarding it, and you'd get this great imbalance in material wealth or intellectual wealth or whatever kind of wealth you want to talk about. And so it really forces us, all of us, to think about, okay, who am I going to pass on? We all talk about legacy. We wouldn't think about legacy if we didn't die. And so what I'm asking you to do is actually look at the Old Testament, the historical books, and notice what you see there. Sometimes you've got a wise king followed by a foolish son. Sometimes you've got a foolish king followed by a wise son. Sometimes what happens is it's not the son that inherits, it's someone completely different. And so the Bible tells us that God uses death as a way to bring things back into balance, to transfer the wealth of the wicked to the righteous so it could be used for God's purposes. So a lot of people think if there's an all-powerful, all-loving God, none of us would have to die. Death is a great way to keep evil in check and a great way to make sure that we're all thinking, righteous and the wicked, thinking about who am I going to invest my life into? How am I going to transfer what I've been working on all my life to the next generation? And what can I do to ensure that it's used for God's purposes in the very back?
Death, of course, is a particular event, a particular finite time that happens all of a sudden. Your discussion here and last week reminds me of a comment that I heard in a sermon by Dr. David Geirdson a few months ago, where he said that old age is God's gift to humanity to allow us the opportunity to think about these things and to get rid of the stuff we've accumulated earlier in life.
Right. Yeah.
So that is a process going on, like you talk about your succession and whatnot, but getting into that point of elder age is what kind of prompts us, I think, in some fashion, recognize our frailty, recognizing our limitations relative to earlier times, that we need to do this.
We do. And one thing I'm kind of leading to is that it's the baby boom generation that has been the least responsible in actually thinking about what they're going to be passing on.
And so,
well, that's part of it. You know, people have been asking, why the baby boomers and not other generations? It's because we've been blessed with health and wealth so we can actually live long enough where a lot of us don't even think about the fact, you know what, maybe 30 years from now, I'm not going to be around. And, you know, I could just put it all in my will, but maybe I need to be passing on some now. Because if I wait till I die, who knows what's going to happen to it. So, I mean, you may have a nice, beautifully written will, but, you know, wills get challenged. People fight over things. And one of the ways to settle that is actually be thinking about your legacy and about passing on, quote, your stuff, whether it be material, intellectual, emotional, whatever. Anyway, I'm over time. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you for being alive in a time when discoveries like what was announced this past Thursday actually happen, and happen fairly routinely. And Father, I pray that we be able to use these kinds of new breakthroughs in the book of nature to bring people to the book of Scripture, that they may realize that these incredible scientific discoveries are indeed giving us stronger evidence that the God of the Bible exists, stronger evidence for the redemptive plan we see laid out in Scripture, and Father, that we would be more confident as believers in sharing our faith and more productive in sharing our faith. And Father, too, we want to thank you for what you had recorded there in Ecclesiastes 4. Help us to meditate in that text and to recognize that death is something that you blessed humanity with. Help us to see death as a gift, and help us to use that gift in a way that will maximize your kingdom and further your kingdom for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.